glasses would pick up the expression on a face easily at this distance. Graham could hear traffic in the distance, and far away he heard a beagle on a case. A cicada started its numbing bandsaw buzz and drowned out the other sounds. A thick limb just above him joined the trunk at a right angle to the Jacoby house. He pulled himself up until he could see and leaned around the trunk to look at it. Close by his cheek, a soft drink can was wedged between the limb and the trunk. "I love it," Graham whispered into the bark. "Oh, sweet Jesus, yes, come on, can." Still, a child might have left it. He climbed higher on his side of the tree, dicey work on small branches, and moved around until he could look down on the big limb. A patch of outer bark on the upper side of the limb was shaved away, leaving a field of green inner bark the size of a playing card. Centered in the green rectangle, carved through to the white wood, Graham saw a symbol. It was done carefully and cleanly, with a very sharp knife. It was not the work of a child. Graham photographed the mark, carefully bracketing his exposures. The view from the big limb was good, and it had been improved. The stub of a small branch jutted down from the limb above. It had been clipped off to clear the view. The fibers were compressed, and the end slightly flattened in the cutting. Graham looked for the severed branch. If it had been on the ground, he would have seen it. There, tangled in the limbs below, brown withered leaves amid the green foliage. The laboratory would need both sides of the cut in order to measure the pitch of the cutting edges. That meant coming back here with a saw. He made several photographs of the stub. All the while, he mumbled to himself, "I think that after you killed the cat and threw it into the yard, my man, you climbed up here and waited. I think you watched the children and passed the time whittling and dreaming. When night came, you saw them passing their bright windows, and you watched the shades go down, and you saw the lights go out one by one. And after a while, you climbed down and went into them. Didn't you? It wouldn't be too hard to climb straight down from the big limb with a flashlight and the bright moon rising." It was a hard enough climb for Graham. He stuck a twig into the opening of the soft drink can, gently lifted it from the crotch of the tree, and descended, holding the twig in his teeth when he had to use both hands. Back at the housing project, Graham found that someone had written, "Levon is a doo-doo head," in the dust on the side of his car. The height of the writing indicated that even the youngest residents were well along in literacy. He wondered if they had written on the Tooth Fairy's car. Graham sat for a few minutes looking up at the rows of windows. There appeared to be about 100 units. It was possible that someone might remember a white stranger in the parking lot late at night. Even though a month had passed, it was well worth trying. To ask every resident and get it done quickly, he would need the help of the Birmingham police. He fought the temptation to send the drink can straight to Jimmy Price in Washington. He had to ask the Birmingham police for manpower. It would be better to give them what he had. Dusting the can would be a straightforward job. Trying for fingerprints etched by acid sweat was another matter. Price could still do it after Birmingham dusted, as long as the can wasn't handled with bare fingers. Better give it to the police. He knew the FBI document section would fall on the carving like a rabid mongoose. Pictures of that for everybody, nothing lost there. He called Birmingham Homicide from the Jacoby house. The detectives arrived just as the realtor, Guillen, was ushering in his prospective buyers. Chapter 11. Eileen was reading a National Tattler article called "Filth in Your Bread," when Dollarhide came into the cafeteria. She had eaten only the filling in her tuna salad sandwich. Behind the red goggles, Dollarhide's eyes zigged down the front page of the Tattler. Cover lines, in addition to Filth in Your Bread, included Elvis at Secret Love Retreat, Exclusive Picks, Stunning Breakthrough for Cancer Victims, and the big banner line, Hannibal the Cannibal Helps Lawmen, Cops Consult Fiend in Tooth Fairy Murders. He stood at the window, absently stirring his coffee, until he heard Eileen get up. She dumped her tray in the trash container and was about to throw in the Tattler when Dollarhide touched her shoulder. "May I have that paper, Eileen?" "Sure, Mr. D. I just get it for the horoscopes." Dollarhide read it in his office with the door closed. Freddie Lowndes had two bylines in the same double-page center spread. The main story was a breathless reconstruction of the Jacoby and Leeds murders. Since the police had not divulged many of the specifics, Lowndes consulted his imagination for lurid details. Dollarhide found them banal. The sidebar was more interesting. "Insane Fiend Consulted in Mass Murders by Cop He Tried to Kill" by Freddie Lowndes. Baltimore, Maryland. Federal manhunters, stymied in their search for the Tooth Fairy, psychopathic slayer of entire families in Birmingham and Atlanta, have turned to the most savage killer in captivity for help. Dr. Hannibal Lecter, whose unspeakable practices were reported in these pages 3 years ago, was consulted this week in his maximum security asylum cell by ace investigator William Will Graham. Graham suffered a near-fatal slashing at Lecter's hands when he unmasked the masked murderer. He was brought back from early retirement to spearhead the hunt for the Tooth Fairy. What went on in this bizarre meeting of two mortal enemies? What was Graham after? "It takes one to catch one," a high federal official told this reporter. He was referring to Lecter, known as Hannibal the Cannibal, who is both a psychiatrist and a mass murderer. Or was he referring to Graham? The Tattler had learned that Graham, former instructor in forensics at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, was once confined to a mental institution for a period of 4 weeks. Federal officials refused to say why they placed a man with a history of mental instability at the forefront of a desperate manhunt. The nature of Graham's mental problem was not revealed, but one former psychiatric worker called it deep depression. Garman Evans, a paraprofessional formerly employed at Bethesda Naval Hospital, said Graham was admitted to the psychiatric wing soon after he killed Garrett Jacob Hobbs, the Minnesota Shrike. Graham shot Hobbs to death in 1975, ending Hobbs' 8-month reign of terror in Minneapolis. Evans said Graham was withdrawn and refused to eat or speak during the first weeks of his stay. Graham has never been an FBI agent. Veteran observers attribute this to the Bureau's strict screening procedures, designed to detect instability. Federal sources would reveal only that Graham originally worked in the FBI crime laboratory and was assigned teaching duties at the FBI Academy after outstanding work both in the laboratory and in the field, where he served as a special investigator. The Tattler learned that before his federal service, Graham was in the homicide division of the New Orleans Police Department, a post he left to attend graduate school in forensics at George Washington University. One New Orleans officer who served with Graham commented, "Well, you can call him retired, but the feds like to know he's around. It's like having a king snake under the house. They may not see him much, but it's nice to know he's there to eat the moccasins." Dr. Lecter is confined for the rest of his life. If he is ever declared sane, he will have to stand trial on 9 counts of first-degree murder. Lecter's attorney says the mass murderer spends his time writing useful articles for the scientific journals and has an ongoing dialogue by mail with some of the most respected figures in psychiatry. Dollarhide stopped reading and looked at the pictures. There were two of them above the sidebar. One showed Lecter pinned against the side of a state trooper's car. The other was the picture of Will Graham, taken by Freddie Lowndes, outside the Baltimore State Hospital. A small photograph of Lowndes ran beside each of his bylines. Dollarhide looked at the pictures for a long time. He ran the tip of his forefinger over them slowly, back and forth, his touch exquisitely sensitive to the rough newsprint. Ink left a smudge on his fingertip. He wet the smudge with his tongue and wiped it off on a Kleenex. Then he cut out the sidebar and put it in his pocket. On his way home from the plant, Dollarhide bought toilet paper of the quick-dissolving kind used in boats and campers, and a nasal inhaler. He felt good despite his hay fever. Like many people who have undergone extensive rhinoplasty, Dollarhide had no hair in his nose, and hay fever plagued him. So did upper respiratory infections. When a stalled truck held him up for 10 minutes on the Missouri River Bridge to St. Charles, he sat patiently. His black van was carpeted, cool and quiet. Handel's water music played on the stereo. He rippled his fingers on the steering wheel in time with the music and dabbed at his nose. Two women in a convertible were in the lane beside him. They wore shorts and blouses tied across the midriff. Dollarhide looked down into the convertible from his van. They seemed tired and bored, squinting into the lowering sun. The woman on the passenger side had her head against the seat back and her feet on the dash. Her slumped posture made two creases across her bare stomach. Dollarhide could see a suck mark on the inside of her thigh. She caught him looking, sat up, and crossed her legs. He saw a weary distaste in her face. She said something to the woman at the wheel. Both looked straight ahead. He knew they were talking about him. He was so glad it did not make him angry. Few things made him angry anymore. He knew that he was developing a becoming dignity. The music was very pleasant. The traffic in front of Dollarhide began to move. The lane beside him was still stalled. He looked forward to getting home. He tapped the wheel in time with the music and rolled down the window with his other hand. He hawked and spit a blob of green phlegm into the lap of the woman beside him, hitting her just beside the navel. Her curses sounded high and thin over the handle as he drove away. Dollarhide's great ledger was at least 100 years old. Bound in black leather with brass corners, it was so heavy a sturdy machine table supported it in the locked closet at the top of the stairs. From the moment he saw it at the bankruptcy sale of an old St. Louis printing company, Dollarhide knew it should be his. Now, bathed and in his kimono, he unlocked the closet and rolled it out. When the book was centered beneath the painting of the great red dragon, he settled himself in a chair and opened it. The smell of foxed paper rose to his face. Across the first page, in large letters he had illuminated himself, were the words from Revelation. "And there came a great red dragon also." The first item in the book was the only one not neatly mounted. Loose between the pages was a yellowed photograph of Dollarhide as a small child with his grandmother on the steps of the big house. He is holding to grandmother's skirt. Her arms are folded and her back is straight. Dollarhide turned past it. He ignored it as though it had been left there by mistake. There were many clippings in the ledger, the earliest ones about the disappearances of elderly women in St. Louis and Toledo. Pages between the clippings were covered with Dollarhide's writing, black ink in a fine copper plate script, not unlike William Blake's own handwriting. Fastened in the margins, ragged bits of scalp trailed their tails of hair like comets pressed in God's scrapbook. The Jacoby clippings from Birmingham were there, along with film cartridges and slides, set in pockets glued to the pages. So were stories on the Leedses, with film beside them. The term Tooth Fairy had not appeared in the press until Atlanta. The name was marked out in all the Leeds stories. Now, Dollarhide did the same with his Tatler clipping, obliterating Tooth Fairy with angry slashes of a red marker pen. He turned to a new blank page in his ledger and trimmed the Tatler clipping to fit. Should Graham's picture go in? The words, criminally insane, carved in the stone above Graham, offended Dollarhide. He hated the sight of any place of confinement. Graham's face was closed to him. He set it aside for the time being. But Lecter, this was not a good picture of the doctor. Dollarhide had a better one, which he fetched from a box in his closet. It was published upon Lecter's committal and showed the fine eyes. Still, it was not satisfactory. In Dollarhide's mind, Lecter's likeness should be the dark portrait of a Renaissance prince. For Lecter, alone among all men, might have the sensitivity and experience to understand the glory, the majesty of Dollarhide's becoming. Dollarhide felt that Lecter knew the unreality of the people who die to help you in these things. Understood that they are not flesh, but light and air and color and quick sounds quickly ended when you change them, like balloons of color bursting, that they are more important for the changing, more important than the lives they scrabble after, pleading. Dollarhide bore screams as a sculptor bears dust from the beaten stone. Lecter was capable of understanding that blood and breath were only elements undergoing change to fuel his radiance, just as the source of light is burning. He would like to meet Lecter, talk and share with him, rejoice with him in their shared vision, be recognized by him as John the Baptist recognized the one who came after. Sit on him as the dragon sat on 666 in Blake's Revelation series, and film his death as, dying, he melded with the strength of the dragon. Dollarhide pulled on a new pair of rubber gloves and went to his desk. He unrolled and discarded the outer layer of the toilet paper he had bought. Then he unrolled a strip of 7 sheets and tore it off. Printing carefully on the tissue with his left hand, he wrote a letter to Lecter. Speech is never a reliable indicator of how a person writes. You never know. Dollarhide's speech was bent and pruned by disabilities, real and imagined, and the difference between his speech and his writing was startling. Still, he found he could not say the most important things he felt. He wanted to hear from Lecter. He needed a personal response before he could tell Dr. Lecter the important things. How could he manage that? He rummaged through his box of Lecter clippings, read them all again. Finally, a simple way occurred to him, and he wrote again. The letter seemed too diffident and shy when he read it over. He had signed it, Avid Fan. He brooded over the signature for several minutes. Avid fan, indeed. His chin rose an imperious fraction. He put his gloved thumb in his mouth, removed his dentures, and placed them on the blotter. The upper plate was unusual. The teeth were normal, straight, and white, but the pink acrylic upper part was a tortuous shape cast to fit the twists and fissures of his gums. Attached to the plate was a soft plastic prosthesis with an obturator on top, which helped him close off his soft palate in speech. He took a small case from his desk. It held another set of teeth. The upper casting was the same, but there was no prosthesis. The crooked teeth had dark stains between them and gave off a faint stench. They were identical to grandmother's teeth in the bedside glass downstairs. Dolarhyde's nostrils flared at the odor. He opened his sunken smile and put them in place and wet them with his tongue. He folded the letter across the signature and bit down hard on it. When he opened the letter again, the signature was enclosed in an oval bite mark, his notary seal, an imprimatur flecked with old blood. Chapter 12. Attorney Byron Metcalf took off his tie at 5 o'clock, made himself a drink, and put his feet up on his desk. "Sure you won't have one?" "Another time." Graham, picking the cockle burrs off his cuffs, was grateful for the air conditioning. "I didn't know the Jacobys very well," Metcalf said. "They'd only been here 3 months. My wife and I were there for drinks a couple of times. Ed Jacoby came to me for a new will soon after he was transferred here. That's how I met him." "But you're his executor." "Yes. His wife was listed first as executor, then me as alternate, in case she was deceased or infirm. He has a brother in Philadelphia, but I gather they weren't close."
"You were an assistant district attorney?"
"Yep. 1968 to 1972. I ran for DA in 1972. It was close, but I lost. I'm not sorry now."
"How do you see what happened here, Mr. Metcalf?"
"The first thing I thought about was Joseph Yablonsky, the labor leader."
Graham nodded.
"A crime with a motive, power in that case, disguised as an insane attack. We went over Ed Jacoby's papers with a fine-tooth comb, Jerry Estridge from the DA's office, and I. Nothing. Nobody stood to make much money off Ed Jacoby's death. He made a big salary, and he had some patents paying off, but he spent it almost as fast as it came in. Everything was to go to the wife, with a little land in California, entailed to the kids and their descendants. He had a small spendthrift trust set up for the surviving son. It'll pay his way through 3 more years of college. I'm sure he'll still be a freshman by then."
"Niles Jacoby."
"Yeah. The kid gave Ed a big pain in the ass. He lived with his mother in California. Went to Chino for theft. I gather his mother's a flake. Ed went out there to see about him last year. Brought him back to Birmingham, put him in school at Bardwell Community College. Tried to keep him at home, but he dumped on the other kids and made it unpleasant for everybody. Mrs. Jacoby put up with it for a while, but finally they moved him to a dorm."
"Where was he?"
"On the night of June 28th.
Metcalf's eyes were hooded as he looked at Graham.
"The police wondered about that, and so did I. He went to a movie and then back to school. It's verified. Besides, he has type O blood. Mr. Graham, I have to pick up my wife in half an hour. We can talk tomorrow if you like. Tell me how I can help you."
"I'd like to see the Jacoby's personal effects, diaries, pictures, whatever."
"There's not much of that. They lost about everything in a fire in Detroit before they moved down here. Nothing suspicious. Ed was welding in the basement. The sparks got into some paint he had stored down there, and the house went up. There's some personal correspondence. I have it in the lockboxes with the small valuables. I don't remember any diaries. Everything else is in storage. Niles may have some pictures, but I doubt it. Tell you what, I'm going to court 9:30 in the morning, but I could get you into the bank to look at the stuff and come back by for you afterward."
"Fine," Graham said. "One other thing. I could use copies of everything to do with the probate, claims against the estate, any contest of the will, correspondence. I'd like to have all the paper."
"The Atlanta DA's office asked me for that already. They're comparing with the Leeds estate in Atlanta, I know," Metcalf said.
"Still, I'd like copies for myself."
"Okay, copies to you. You don't really think it's money, though, do you?"
"No. I just keep hoping the same name will come up here and in Atlanta."
"So do I."
Student housing at Bardwell Community College was four small dormitory buildings set around a littered quadrangle of beaten earth. A stereo war was in progress when Graham got there. Opposing sets of speakers on the motel-style balconies blared at each other across the quad. It was Kiss versus the 1812 Overture. A water balloon arched high in the air and burst on the ground 10 feet from Graham. He ducked under a clothesline and stepped over a bicycle to get through the sitting room of the suite Niles Jacoby shared. The door to Jacoby's bedroom was ajar, and music blasted through the crack. Graham knocked. No response. He pushed open the door. A tall boy with a spotty face sat on one of the twin beds, sucking on a 4-foot bong pipe. A girl in dungarees lay on the other bed. The boy's head jerked around to face Graham. He was struggling to think. "I'm looking for Niles Jacoby." The boy appeared stupefied. Graham switched off the stereo. "I'm looking for Niles Jacoby."
"Just some stuff for my asthma, man. Don't you have a knock?"
"Where's Niles Jacoby?"
"The fuck if I know. What do you want him for?"
Graham showed him the tin. "Try real hard to remember."
"Oh, shit," the girl said. "Narc, God damn it, I ain't worth it. Look, let's talk about this a minute, man."
"Let's talk about where Jacoby is."
"I think I can find out for you," the girl said.
Graham waited while she asked in the other rooms. Everywhere she went, commodes flushed. There were few traces of Niles Jacoby in the room. One photograph of the Jacoby family lay on a dresser. Graham lifted a glass of melting ice off it and wiped away the wet ring with his sleeve. The girl returned.
"Try the Hateful Snake," she said.
The Hateful Snake bar was in a storefront with the windows painted dark green. The vehicles parked outside were an odd assortment, big trucks looking bobtailed without their trailers, compact cars, a lilac convertible, old Dodges and Chevrolets crippled with high rear ends for the drag strip look, 4 full-dress Harley-Davidsons. An air conditioner mounted in the transom over the door dripped steadily onto the sidewalk. Graham ducked around the dribble and went inside. The place was crowded and smelled of disinfectant and stale canoe. The bartender, a husky woman in overalls, reached over heads at the service bar to hand Graham his Coke. She was the only woman there. Niles Jacoby, dark and razor-thin, was at the jukebox. He put the money in the machine, but the man beside him pushed the buttons. Jacoby looked like a dissolute schoolboy, but the one selecting the music did not. Jacoby's companion was a strange mixture. He had a boyish face on a knobby, muscular body. He wore a T-shirt and jeans, worn white over the objects in his pockets. His arms were knotty with muscle, and he had large, ugly hands. One professional tattoo on his left forearm said, "Born to fuck." A crude jailhouse tattoo on his other arm said, "Randy." His short jail haircut had grown out unevenly. As he reached for a button on the lighted jukebox, Graham saw a small shaved patch on his forearm. Graham felt a cold place in his stomach. He followed Niles Jacoby and Randy through the crowd to the back of the room. They sat in a booth. Graham stopped 2 feet from the table. "Niles, my name is Will Graham. I need to talk with you for a few minutes." Randy looked up with a bright false smile. One of his front teeth was dead.
"Do I know you?"
"No. Niles, I want to talk to you." Niles arched a quizzical eyebrow. Graham wondered what had happened to him in Chino.
"We were having a private conversation here, butt out," Randy said.
Graham looked thoughtfully at the marred, muscular forearms, the dot of adhesive in the crook of the elbow, the shaved patch where Randy had tested the edge of his knife. Knife fighter's mange. I'm afraid of Randy. Fire or fall back.
Did you hear me? Randy said. Butt out!
Graham unbuttoned his jacket and put his identification on the table. Sit still, Randy. If you try to get up, you're going to have two navels.
I'm sorry, sir.
Instant inmate sincerity. Randy, I want you to do something for me. I want you to reach in your left back pocket. Just use two fingers. You'll find a 5-inch blade in there with a flicket clamped to the blade. Put it on the table. Thank you. Graham dropped the knife into his pocket. It felt greasy. Now, in your other pocket is your wallet. Get it out. You sold some blood today, didn't you?
Well, so what?
So hand me the slip they gave you, the one you show next time at the blood bank. Spread it out on the table. Randy had type O blood. Scratch, Randy. How long have you been out of jail?
3 weeks.
Who's your parole officer?
I'm not on parole.
That's probably a lie. Graham wanted to roust Randy. He could get him for carrying a knife over the legal length. Being in a place with a liquor license was a parole violation. Graham knew he was angry at Randy because he had feared him. Randy?
Yeah?
Get out. I don't know what I can tell you. I didn't know my father very well, Niles Jacoby said as Graham drove him to the school. He left Mother when I was 3, and I didn't see him after that. Mother wouldn't have it.
He came to see you last spring.
Yes.
At Chino.
You know about that?
I'm just trying to get it straight.
What happened?
Well, there he was in visitors, uptight and trying not to look around. So many people treat it like the zoo. I'd heard a lot about him from Mother, but he didn't look so bad. He was just a man standing there in a tacky sport coat.
What did he say?
Well, I expected him either to jump right in my shit or to be real guilty. That's the way it goes mostly in visitors. But he just asked me if I thought I could go to school. He said he'd go custody if I'd go to school and try.
You have to help yourself a little. Try and help yourself, and I'll see you get in school, and like that.
How long before you got out?
2 weeks.
Niles, did you ever talk about your family while you were in Chino, to your cellmates or anybody?
Niles Jacoby looked at Graham quickly.
Oh, I see. No, not about my father. I hadn't thought about him in years. Why would I talk about him?
How about here? Did you ever take any of your friends over to your parents' house?
Parents? Not parents. She was not my mother.
Did you ever take anybody over there? School friends or...
Or rough trade, Officer Graham?
That's right.
No.
Never?
Not once.
Did he ever mention any kind of threat? Was he ever disturbed about anything in the last month or two before it happened?
He was disturbed the last time I talked to him, but it was just my grades. I had a lot of cuts. He bought me 2 alarm clocks. There wasn't anything else that I know of.
Do you have any personal papers of his? Correspondence, photographs, anything?
No.
You have a picture of the family. It's on the dresser in your room, near the bong.
That's not my bong. I wouldn't put that filthy thing in my mouth.
I need the picture. I'll have it copied and send it back to you. What else do you have?
Jacoby shook a cigarette out of his pack and patted his pocket for matches. That's all. I can't imagine why they gave that to me. My father smiling at Mrs. Jacoby and all the little munchkins. You can have it. He never looked like that to me.
Graham needed to know the Jacobys. Their new acquaintances in Birmingham were little help. Byron Metcalf gave him the run of the lockboxes. He read the thin stack of letters, mostly business, and poked through the jewelry and the silver. For 3 hot days, he worked in the warehouse where the Jacobys' household goods were stored. Metcalf helped him at night. Every crate on every pallet was opened and their contents examined. Police photographs helped Graham see where things had been in the house. Most of the furnishings were new, bought with the insurance from the Detroit fire. The Jacobys hardly had time to leave their marks on their possessions. One item, a bedside table with traces of fingerprint powder still on it, held Graham's attention. In the center of the tabletop was a blob of green wax. For the second time, he wondered if the killer liked candlelight. The Birmingham forensics unit was good about sharing. The blurred print of the end of a nose was the best Birmingham and Jimmy Price in Washington could do with the soft drink can from the tree. The FBI laboratory's firearms and tool mark section reported on the severed branch. The blades that clipped it were thick, with a shallow pitch. It had been done with a bolt cutter. Documents section had referred the mark cut in the bark to the Asian Studies Department at Langley. Graham sat on a packing case at the warehouse and read the long report. Asian Studies advised that the mark was a Chinese character, which meant, "you hit it," or "you hit it on the head," an expression sometimes used in gambling. It was considered a positive or lucky sign. The character also appeared on a mahjong piece, the Asian scholars said. It marked the Red Dragon. Chapter 13. Crawford at FBI headquarters in Washington was on the telephone with Graham at the Birmingham airport when his secretary leaned into the office and flagged his attention. "Dr. Chilton at Baltimore Hospital on 2706. He says it's urgent." Crawford nodded. "Hang on, Will." He punched the telephone. "Crawford."
"Frederick Chilton, Mr. Crawford, at the..."
"Yes, doctor."
"I have a note here. Or 2 pieces of a note that appears to be from the man who killed those people in Atlanta. And
where did you get it?"
"From Hannibal Lecter's cell. It's written on toilet tissue, of all things, and it has teeth marks pressed in it."
"Can you read it to me without handling it anymore?"
Straining to sound calm, Chilton read it. "My dear Dr. Lecter, I wanted to tell you I'm delighted that you have taken an interest in me. And when I learned of your vast correspondence, I thought, dare I? Of course I do. I don't believe you'd tell them who I am, even if you knew. Besides, what particular body I currently occupy is trivia. The important thing is what I am becoming. I know that you alone can understand this. I have some things I'd love to show you. Someday, perhaps, if circumstances permit. I hope we can correspond."
"Mr. Crawford, there's a hole torn and punched out. Then it says, 'I have admired you for years and have a complete collection of your press notices. Actually, I think of them as unfair reviews, as unfair as mine. They like to sling demeaning nicknames, don't they? The Tooth Fairy. What could be more inappropriate? It would shame me for you to see that if I didn't know you had suffered the same distortions in the press. Investigator Graham interests me. Odd looking for a flatfoot, isn't he? Not very handsome, but purposeful looking. You should have taught him not to meddle. Forgive the stationery. I chose it because it will dissolve very quickly if you should have to swallow it. There's a piece missing here, Mr. Crawford. I'll read the bottom part. If I hear from you next time, I might send you something wet. Until then, I remain your avid fan." silence after Chilton finished reading. "Are you there?"
"Yes. Does Lecter know you have the note?"
"Not yet. This morning he was moved to a holding cell while his quarters were cleaned. Instead of using a proper rag, the cleaning man was pulling handfuls of toilet paper off the roll to wipe down the sink. He found the note wound up in the roll and brought it to me. They bring me anything they find hidden."
"Where's Lecter now?"
"Still in the holding cell."
"Can he see his quarters at all from there?"
"Let me think. No, he can't."
"Wait a second, Doctor."
Crawford put Chilton on hold. He stared at the two winking buttons on his telephone for several seconds without seeing them. Crawford, Fisher of Men, was watching his cork move against the current. He got Graham again.
"Well, a note, maybe from the Tooth Fairy, hidden in Lecter's cell at Baltimore. Sounds like a fan letter. He wants Lecter's approval. He's curious about you. He's asking questions."
How was Lecter supposed to answer?
"Don't know yet. Parts torn out, parts scratched out. Looks like there's a chance of correspondence, as long as Lecter's not aware that we know. I want the note for the lab, and I want to toss his cell, but it'll be risky. If Lecter gets wise, who knows, he could warn the bastard. We need the link, but we need the note, too."
Crawford told Graham where Lecter was held, how the note was found. "It's 40 miles over to Baltimore. I can't wait for you, buddy. What do you think?"
10 people dead in a month. We can't play a long mail game. I say go for it."
"I am," Crawford said. "See you in 2 hours." Crawford hailed his secretary.
"Sarah, order a helicopter. I want the next thing smoking, and I don't care whose it is, ours, DCPD, or Marines. I'll be on the roof in 5 minutes. Call documents. Tell them to have a document case up there. Tell Herbert to scramble a search team. On the roof, 5 minutes.
He picked up Chilton's line.
"Dr. Chilton, we have to search Lecter's cell without his knowledge, and we need your help. Have you mentioned this to anybody else?"
"No."
"Where's the cleaning man who found the note?"
"He's here in my office."
"Keep him there, please, and tell him to keep quiet. How long has Lecter been out of his cell?"
"About half an hour."
"Is that unusually long?"
"No, not yet. But it takes only about a half hour to clean it. Soon he'll begin to wonder what's wrong."
"Okay, do this for me. Call your building superintendent or engineer, who's ever in charge. Tell him to shut off the water in the building and to pull the circuit breakers on Lecter's hall. Have the super walk down the hall, past the holding cell, carrying tools. He'll be in a hurry, pissed off, too busy to answer any questions. Got it? Tell him he'll get an explanation from me. Have the garbage pickup canceled for today if they haven't already come. Don't touch the note, okay? We're coming."
Crawford called the section chief, scientific analysis.
"Brian, I have a note coming in on the fly, possibly from the Tooth Fairy. Number one priority. It has to go back where it came from within the hour and unmarked. It'll go to hair and fiber, latent prints and documents, then to you. So coordinate with them, will you?"
"Yes, I'll walk it through. I'll deliver it to you myself." It was warm. The federally mandated 80 degrees in the elevator when Crawford came down from the roof with the note, his hair blown silly by the helicopter blast. He was mopping his face by the time he reached the hair and fiber section of the laboratory. Hair and fiber is a small section, calm and busy. The common room is stacked with boxes of evidence sent by police departments all over the country. Swatches of tape that have sealed mouths and bound wrists, torn and stained clothing, deathbed sheets. Crawford spotted Beverly Katz through the window of an examining room as he wove his way between the boxes. She had a pair of child's coveralls suspended from a hanger over a table covered with white paper. Working under bright lights in the draft-free room, she brushed the coveralls with a metal spatula, carefully working with the whale and across it, with the nap and against it. A sprinkle of dirt and sand fell to the paper. With it, falling through the still air more slowly than sand, but faster than lint, came a tightly coiled hair. She cocked her head and looked at it with her bright robin's eye. Crawford could see her lips moving. He knew what she was saying. "Gotcha." That's what she always said. Crawford pecked on the glass, and she came out fast, stripping off her white gloves. "It hasn't been printed yet, right?" "No. I'm set up in the next examining room." She put on a fresh pair of gloves while Crawford opened the document case. The note, in two pieces, was contained gently between two sheets of plastic film. Beverly Katz saw the tooth impressions and glanced up at Crawford, not wasting time with the question. He nodded. The impressions matched the clear overlay of the killer's bite he had carried with him to Chesapeake. Crawford watched through the window as she lifted the note on a slender dowel and hung it over white paper. She looked it over with a powerful glass, then fanned it gently. She tapped the dowel with the edge of a spatula and went over the paper beneath it with the magnifying glass. Crawford looked at his watch. Katz flipped the note over another dowel to get the reverse side up. She removed one tiny object from its surface with tweezers almost as fine as a hair. She photographed the torn ends of the note under high magnification and returned it to its case. She put a clean pair of white gloves in the case with it. The white gloves, the signal not to touch, would always be beside the evidence until it was checked for fingerprints. "That's it," she said, handing the case back to Crawford. "One hair, maybe a 1/32 of an inch, a couple of blue grains. I'll work it up. What else have you got?" Crawford gave her three marked envelopes. "Hair from Lecter's comb, whiskers from the electric razor they let him use. This is hair from the cleaning man. Gotta go." "See you later," Katz said. "Love your hair." Jimmy Price, in latent fingerprints, winced at the sight of the porous toilet paper. He squinted fiercely over the shoulder of his technician, operating the helium-cadmium laser as they tried to find a fingerprint and make it fluoresce. Glowing smudges appeared on the paper. Perspiration stains. Nothing. Crawford started to ask him a question, thought better of it, waited with the blue light reflecting off his glasses. "We know three guys handle this without gloves, right?" Price said. "Yeah, the cleanup man, Lecter, and Chilton. The fellow scrubbing sinks probably had washed the oil off his fingers, but the others, this stuff is terrible." Price held the paper to the light, forceps steady in his mottled old hand. "I could fume it, Jack, but I couldn't guarantee the iodine stains would fade out in the time you've got. Ninhydrin? Boost it with heat?" Ordinarily, Crawford would not have ventured a technical suggestion to Price, but he was floundering for anything. He expected a huffy reply, but the old man sounded rueful and sad. "No, we couldn't wash it after. I can't get you a print off this, Jack. There isn't one." "Fuck," Crawford said. The old man turned away. Crawford put his hand on Price's bony shoulder. "Hell, Jimmy, if there was one, you'd have found it." Price didn't answer. He was unpacking a pair of hands that had arrived in another matter. Dry ice smoked in his wastebasket. Crawford dropped the white gloves into the smoke. Disappointment growling in his stomach, Crawford hurried on to documents, where Lloyd Bowman was waiting. Bowman had been called out of court, and the abrupt sheer in his concentration left him blinking like a man just wakened. "I congratulate you on your hairstyle. A brave departure," Bowman said, his hands quick and careful, as he transferred the note to his work surface. "How long do I have?" 20 minutes, max." The two pieces of the note seemed to glow under Bowman's lights. His blotter showed dark green through a jagged oblong hole in the upper piece. "The main thing, the first thing, is how Lecter was to reply," Crawford said when Bowman had finished reading. Instructions for answering were probably in the part torn out. Bowman worked steadily with his lights and filters and copy camera as he talked. Here, in the top piece, he says, "I hope we can correspond," and then the whole begins. Lecter scratched over that with a felt-tip pen, and then folded it and pinched most of it out. He doesn't have anything to cut with. Bowman photographed the tooth impressions and the back of the note under extremely oblique light, his shadow leaping from wall to wall as he moved the light through 360 degrees around the paper, and his hands made phantom folding motions in the air. "Now we can mash just a little." Bowman put the note between two panes of glass to flatten the jagged edges of the hole. The tatters were smeared with vermilion ink. He was chanting under his breath. On the third repetition, Crawford made out what he was saying. "You're so sly, but so am I." Bowman switched filters on his small television camera and focused it on the note. He darkened the room until there was only the dull red glow of a lamp and the blue-green of his monitor screen. The words, "I hope we can correspond," and the jagged hole appeared enlarged on the screen. The ink smear was gone, and on the tattered edges appeared fragments of writing. "Aniline dyes and colored inks are transparent to infrared," Bowman said. "These could be the tips of T's here and here. On the end is the tail of what could be an M or N, or possibly an R." Bowman took a photograph and turned the lights on. "Jack, there are just two common ways of carrying on a communication that's one-way blind, the phone and publication. Could Lecter take a fast phone call?" "He can take calls, but it's slow, and they have to come in through the hospital switchboard." "Publication is the only safe way, then." "We know this sweetheart reads the Tattler. The stuff about Graham and Lecter was in the Tattler. I don't know of any other paper that carried it. Three T's and an R in Tattler. Personal column, you think? Place to look." Crawford checked with the FBI library, then telephoned instructions to the Chicago field office. Bowman handed him the case as he finished. "The Tattler comes out this evening," Crawford said. "It's printed in Chicago on Mondays and Thursdays. We'll get proofs of the classified pages." "I'll have some more stuff, minor, I think," Bowman said. "Anything useful, fire it straight to Chicago. Fill me in when I get back from the asylum," Crawford said on his way out the door. Chapter 14. The turnstile at Washington's Metro Central spit Graham's fare card back to him, and he came out into the hot afternoon carrying his flight bag. The J. Edgar Hoover building looked like a great concrete cage above the heat shimmer on 10th Street. The FBI's move to the new headquarters had been underway when Graham left Washington. He had never worked there. Crawford met him at the escort desk off the underground driveway to augment Graham's hastily issued credentials with his own. Graham looked tired, and he was impatient with the signing in. Crawford wondered how he felt, knowing that the killer was thinking about him. Graham was issued a magnetically encoded tag, like the one on Crawford's vest. He plugged it into the gate and passed into the long white corridors. Crawford carried his flight bag. "I forgot to tell Sarah to send a car for you. Probably quicker this way."
"Did you get the note back to Lecter all right?"
"Yeah," Crawford said. "I just got back. We poured water on the whole floor, faked a broken pipe and electrical short. We had Simmons... he's the assistant SAC Baltimore now. We had him mopping when Lecter was brought back to his cell. Simmons thinks he bought it."
I kept wondering on the plane if Lecter wrote it himself.
"That bothered me, too, until I looked at it. Bite mark in the paper matches the ones on the women. Also, it's ballpoint, which Lecter doesn't have.
The person who wrote it had read the Tattler, and Lecter hasn't had a Tattler.
Rankin and Willingham tossed the cell. Beautiful job, but they didn't find Diddley. They took Polaroids first to get everything back just right.
Then the cleaning man went in and did what he always does.
So, what do you think?
As far as physical evidence toward an ID, the note is pretty much dreck, Crawford said. Some way, we've got to make the contact work for us, but damn if I know how yet. We'll get the rest of the lab results in a few minutes.
You've got the mail and phone covered at the hospital?
Standing trace and tape order for any time Lecter's on the phone. He made a call Saturday afternoon. He told Chilton he was calling his lawyer. It's a damn Watts line, and I can't be sure.
What did his lawyer say?
Nothing. We got a leased line to the hospital switchboard for Lecter's convenience in the future, so that won't get by us again. We'll fiddle with his mail both ways, starting next delivery. No problem with warrants, thank God.
Crawford bellied up to a door and stuck the tag on his vest into the lock slot.
My new office. Come on in. Decorator had some paint left over from a battleship he was doing. Here's the note. This print is exactly the size.
Graham read it twice. Seeing the spidery line spell his name started a high tone ringing in his head.
The library confirms the Tatler is the only paper that carried a story about Lecter and you, Crawford said, fixing himself an Alka-Seltzer.
Want one of these?
Good for you. It was published Monday night a week ago. It was on the stands Tuesday nationwide, some areas not till Wednesday, Alaska and Maine and places. The Tooth Fairy got one. Couldn't have done it before Tuesday. He reads it, writes to Lecter. Rankin and Willingham are still sifting the hospital trash for the envelope. Bad job. They don't separate the papers from the diapers at Chesapeake.
All right, Lecter gets the note from the Tooth Fairy no sooner than Wednesday. He tears out the part about how to reply and scratches over and pokes out one earlier reference. I don't know why he didn't tear that out, too.
It was in the middle of a paragraph full of compliments, Graham said. He couldn't stand to ruin them. That's why he didn't throw the whole thing away.
He rubbed his temples with his knuckles.
Bowman thinks Lecter will use the Tatler to answer the Tooth Fairy. He says that's probably the setup.
You think he'd answer this thing?
Sure. He's a great correspondent. Pen pals all over. If they're using the Tatler, Lecter would barely have time to get his answer in the issue they'll print tonight, even if he sent it special delivery to the paper the same day he got the Tooth Fairy's note. Chester from the Chicago office is down at the Tatler checking the ads. The printers are putting the paper together right now.
Please, God, don't stir the Tatler up, Graham said.
The shop foreman thinks Chester's a realtor, trying to get a jump on the ads. He's selling him the proof sheets under the table, one by one as they come off. We're getting everything, all the classifieds, just to blow some smoke. All right, say we find out how Lecter was to answer, and we can duplicate the method. Then we can fake a message to the Tooth Fairy. But what do we say? How do we use it?
The obvious thing is to try to get him to come to a mail drop, Graham said. Bait him with something he'd like to see, important evidence that Lecter knows about from talking to me. Some mistake he made that we're waiting for him to repeat.
He'd be an idiot to go for it.
I know. Want to hear what the best bait would be?
I'm not sure I do.
Lecter would be the best bait, Graham said.
Set up how?
It would be hell to do, I know that. We take Lecter into federal custody. Chilton would never sit still for this at Chesapeake. And we stash him in maximum security at a VA psychiatric hospital. We fake an escape.
Oh, Jesus!
We send the Tooth Fairy a message in next week's Tatler after the big escape. It would be Lecter asking him for a rendezvous.
Why in God's name would anybody want to meet Lecter? I mean, even the Tooth Fairy.
To kill him, Jack. Graham got up. There was no window to look out of as he talked. He stood in front of the 10 most wanted, Crawford's only wall decoration. See, the Tooth Fairy could absorb him that way, engulf him, become more than he is.
You sound pretty sure.
I'm not sure. Who's sure? What he said in the note was, I have some things I'd love to show you. Someday, perhaps, if circumstances permit. Maybe it was a serious invitation. I don't think he was just being polite.
Wonder what he's got to show. The victims were intact, nothing missing but a little skin and hair, and that was probably, how did Bloom put it?
Ingested, Graham said. God knows what he's got. Tremont, remember Tremont's costumes in Spokane? While he was strapped to a stretcher, he was pointing with his chin, still trying to show them to the Spokane PD. I'm not sure Lecter would draw the tooth fairy, Jack.